My name is Mark Gravrock. This is our second session this week on the five scrolls, five of the little used books and little understood books of the Old Testament. And one of the claims that I'm making throughout these sessions is that in these books, God is lifting up elements of our lives, elements of our humanity that we often don't think are very spiritual or don't think they really belong to God somehow, but they do. And God is reclaiming them for us and for God's use in these books. In the Song of Songs or the Song of Solomon, you probably know already what gift that is. There are several different ways that you can look at that. The gift of sexuality, the gift of sensuality, the gift of longing and intimacy. And we'll look at some of those dimensions. We're going to start today with some music. And David has graciously consented to come play along with me today.
Consent, it sounds like I'm under pressure.
No, I said graciously.
It's a pleasure.
This is a rough paraphrase of the of Song of Solomon 1, verses 2 and 3, and a verse from chapter 2. Terrible with somebody whose ear is clearer than mine.
So the first verse is about to
me. That's right.
Solomon lived in China. Out of tune.
Thank you.
My older brother, Steve, is four brothers older than I, 4 years older than I, used to write lots of songs. He wrote love songs. He used to have lots of romantic relationships, too, that usually didn't last terribly long. And I asked him once when we were kids, I asked him when I was a kid, and he was vastly older, what do you do with those love songs that you write after you've broken up? And he said, oh, it's simple. I turn them into songs about God. there are all kinds of love songs. Not every love song works, but there are all kinds of love songs that cross that boundary as if there were a boundary between romantic love and talk about God. This is 1972, perhaps, Glen Campbell. I don't know who wrote it. Glen Campbell was singing it. I understand that lately the Rankin family has done this one again, so it's out again. It occurred to me back in college days that while this is clearly a song about romantic love, it could work very well as a song about someone who is searching for God, and at least at this point in the song, not finding yet. Listen to it and see if it works. In the chilly hours and minutes of uncertainty, I long to be in the warm hold of your love and mine. To feel you all around me and to take your hand along the sand. Ah, but I may as well try and catch the wind. When sundown pales the sky, I want to hide a while behind your smile. Everywhere I'd look, your eyes I'd find. For me to love you now, 'twould be the sweetest thing, 'twould make me sing. Ah, but I may as well try and catch the wind. Need a mandolin solo now. When rain has hung leaves with tears, I want you near to kill my fears, to help me leave all my blues behind. Standing in your heart is where I want to be and long to be. Ah, but I may as well try and catch the wind. Oh, but I may as well try and catch the wind. Does it work that way? If we had lots of time, another one that we might do is The Rose. That's a song about love. But if you listen to it with the right ears, it could be a beautiful commentary on Jesus saying, unless a seed fall into the ground and die, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. All kinds of songs that work very well. One of the big questions around this book, Song of Solomon, is it a book about sexuality or is it a book about spirituality? You've probably been part of those discussions at one time or another. My own experience with Song of Solomon goes back to college days primarily, when, of course, we, in our single-sex dorms at that time, the guys would sit around and read these chapters of Song of Solomon and snicker and laugh and all of those things. Some of you may have done that also. I don't know what the women did in their dorms. One fellow student who became a Christian during those college years invited several of us to come to a Bible study on Song of Solomon. I think this was my junior year in college. And primarily I had some reservations about whether you could really do a Bible study on Song of Solomon. But out of consideration for her, primarily, we went and started. This was a Watchman Nee Bible study. I've never seen it since. You may have come across it. And it takes the approach of basically an allegorical approach, where every detail of these love poems has a spiritual meaning, a very specific spiritual connection with Christ. And it was kind of working through the first chapter. Some of the connections seemed rather stretched to us. But by the time we got to the second chapter, it just broke down altogether. And the whole group was just rolling in laughter, trying to make these spiritual connections in stuff that didn't seem spiritual at all. The particular place that my wife and I, she wasn't my wife at the time, she is now, especially enjoyed was in chapter 2, verse 5. Sustain me with raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am sick with love. Of course, Watchman Nee would want to make connections as to exactly what those raisins would be and what the apples would be. And I don't remember what his connections were, but it didn't work, and we just laughed. So for a long time, ever since now, every now and then I'll buy a little box of raisins and an apple and stick it work here and we'll find them. And remind her that I am sick with love. It was Peterson's book, The Five Smooth Stones, several years back. A bunch of us studied this book about a decade ago. That first reopened my thinking about Song of Solomon. My basic conclusion before was Song of Solomon is a collection of love poems. And its primary purpose in being in the scripture is for God to say to us, right clear and up front, sex is not evil, our bodies are not evil, they are my creation, sex is my creation, and it's good and it's beautiful and it's holy. And that in itself is enough. If that's the entire message of Song of Solomon in the canon of scripture, that's enough. We've got enough messages going on in the church and in our society that twist sexuality or that taint it in one way or another. I think it's worth God stepping in and reclaiming and saying, this is mine, and it's good, and it's right. It's Peterson that first began to reopen me to other possibilities in addition to that, of thinking of what this book might have to say to us, or what it might be doing for us. Let me read a couple of passages for you. A couple of my favorite passages are what some scholars have called the dream passages. Whether they are dreams or whether they're meant to be experiences or exactly how you read them is up for grabs. This is poetry. Chapter 3, the first five verses is the first of these. Upon my bed at night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. I will rise now and go about the city, in the streets and the squares. I will seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not. The sentinels found me as they went about in the city. Have you seen him whom my soul loves? Scarcely had I passed them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held him and would not let him go until I brought him into my mother's house, into the chamber of her that conceived me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the wild does, do not stir up or awaken love until it is ready. And the second passage that mirrors it but reverses it is chapter 5, beginning at verse 2. I slept, but my heart was awake. Listen, my beloved is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. I had put off my garment. How could I put it on again? I had bathed my feet. How could I soil them? My beloved thrust his hand into the opening, and my inmost being yearned for him. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh upon the handles of the bolt. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and was gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but did not find him. I called him, but he gave no answer. Making their rounds in the city, the sentinels found me. They beat me, they wounded me, they took away my mantle, those sentinels of the walls. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, tell him this, I am faint with love. In the 16th century, a Spanish mystic, monk and theologian and poet, St. John of the Cross, wrote a poem entitled The Dark Night. He wrote, of course, in Spanish, and this translation is not totally faithful to the Spanish, but it'll at least give you a little bit of a flavor of what he wrote. And as he's writing, as a monk and mystic and theologian and all the rest, he's talking about his relationship with Christ. I'll read you just a few stanzas. On a dark secret night, starving for love and deep in flame, oh happy, lucky flight, unseen I slipped away, my house at last was calm and safe. Blackly free from light, disguised and down a secret way, oh happy, lucky flight. In darkness I escaped my house at last was calm and safe. On that happy night, in secret, no one saw me through the dark, and I saw nothing then, no other light to mark the way, but fire pounding my heart. O night, my guide, O night more friendly than the dawn, O tender night that tied the lover and the loved one in the lover, fused as one. There are more stanzas, but that gives you the flavor. I'll read the last stanza. I lay, I forgot my being, and on my love I leaned my face. All ceased, I left my being, leaving my cares to fade among the lilies far away. Here we have ancient Israelite love poetry taken by a 16th century Spanish mystic and transformed into language about relationship with Christ. And now in the 20th century, poet and vocalist takes and transforms it. Lorena McKennitt is her name. How many of you know Lorena McKennitt's stuff? Familiar with her works? She has transformed this again back into a love poem, at least I think, as I listen to her song. It's a song now, that she means it as romantic love, and yet she keeps the title of the piece as The Dark Night of the Soul, which is interesting. I'm going to play it for you. I wish I had a printout of the words. She has something of an accent, and it's hard to hear the words at some points. But at least some of the words, I think, will come through, and the flavor of the music certainly will. The chorus that she sings says, O night that wast thou wast my guide, O night more lovely than the rising sun, O night that joined the lover to the beloved one. Let me play it for you and see what you hear. Thank you. More passages, and then I want to ask you some questions. Chapter 2. Beginning at verse 8. This is probably my favorite passage in the book. The voice of my beloved. Look, he comes, leaping upon the mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Look, there he stands behind our wall, gazing in at the windows, looking through the lattice. My beloved speaks and says to me, "Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. For now the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing has come. And the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The fig tree puts forth its figs, and the vines are in blossom. They give forth fragrance. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. Oh, my dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the covert of the cliff, let me see your face. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet, and your face is lovely." Chapter 4, verse 9. You have ravished my heart, my sister, my bride. You have ravished my heart with a glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How sweet is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your oils than any spice. Your lips distill nectar, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue. The scent of your garments is like the scent of Lebanon. A garden locked is my sister, my bride, a garden locked, a fountain sealed. Your channel is an orchard of pomegranates with all choicest fruits, henna with nard, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all chief spices. A garden fountain, a well of living water, and flowing streams from Lebanon. Awake, O north wind, and come, O south wind, blow upon my garden, that its fragrance may be wafted abroad. Let my beloved come to his garden, and eat its choicest fruits. I come to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gather my myrrh with my spice. I eat my honeycomb with honey. I drink my wine with milk. Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love. And one last passage in chapter 8. One that's one of the best known passages from this book. Verse 6. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. For love is strong as death, its passion fierce as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire, a raging flame. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. If one offered for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly scorned. This is a book that does not mention God. God appears nowhere in this book, except perhaps in one verse, and it's one we just read. In verse 6, where it says, at the very end of the verse, a raging flame. I put the Hebrew up on the board for you, shalhevet yah, and that usually gets translated something like a very powerful flame or a super abundant flame. Literally, shalhevet yah means the flame of Yahweh. Not very many translations translate it that way. That love and its passion are the flame of Yahweh, which in itself is a wonderful claim. Let me ask you a question then. If there's so much confusion about whether this book is meant to be purely sexual, or whether it's meant to be spiritual, and it often does get translated into or get used as, if not allegory, at least as some kind of a sign of relationship with God. How can that be? What is it that the if even more clearly, if the songs that we were looking at the beginning of our time can be taken either as romantic songs or as songs about God, relationship with God. Why is that? Or to put my question more directly, what do the sexual and the spiritual have to do with each other? What do they have in common?
Intensity.
Intensity.
I want to write these down. Intensity.
Commitment.
Connection.
Love.
Being human.
Mystery.
Confusion and lust with love.
I need some help on that one.
Which part?
I'm not telling. I understand what that means in the sexual. How do you mean that in the spiritual realm?
In the spiritual realm, the reason that there's discomfort in the translation is the confusion of lust with love.
Okay, if I'm hearing you right, then our when I confuse lust and love in the sexual realm, that's a spiritual problem.
It's a spiritual problem, and it's also difficult to convert in your mind that crossover between the ability for the lyrics to be spiritual or loving. So if we're stuck on lust, then we can't cross over.
That's making more sense to me now. Good, thank you. Other things, what else would you put on the list? What do the sexual and the spiritual have in common?
Need.
Passion.
I like that word.
New life.
Seeking the divine. I have to do some more erasing now. Seeking the divine. How do you mean that in terms of the sexual?
The divine in the relationship.
Okay. By divine, at that point, do you mean actually godly, or do you mean just really fantastic?
Both.
Okay. Seeking the divine. What else?
Oneness with the other.
Oneness with the other. I just erased that, didn't I?
Read it before you erased it.
Yeah, oneness. Oneness with someone who is outside me. What else?
Quite a bit.
Say it again?
That's quite a bit.
Okay. Yes.
I know of a missionary whose fiance gave him up when she found out he was going to cross disease. When he had his conversion to God, he actually had a climax and a sexual experience. And I think, and I understand this is not uncommon with some others, they were so committed to God, they became that intimate with him.
That really sounds like the kind of thing that St. John's writing about in his poem.
Yeah.
That kind of, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. The two words that I put in my subtitle for today are the gifts of longing and intimacy. And I think you've covered that. Longing and intimacy are both up there in other words, other ways that you've said that. There's something about the way we are created, not only the way our bodies are created, but even more focally, the way our beings are created, that I long for someone outside myself. I am as a solitary human being is not really a human being.
Incomplete.
And I don't mean that in the kind of sense that everybody's got to couple up. That's not the same thing. Because intimacy happens in all kinds of ways. Some of them are more obviously sexual. some of them are not. There are all kinds of relationships that we have that are to one degree or another a fulfillment of that, both of the longing and of the gift of intimacy. And all of those, I don't want to just substitute God for all of those either, because that's not how we are created. We are created for one another as well as for God. And that's part of the way we are designed. To long for one another, to long to know and to be known, to long to be able to share depth of ourselves and depth of the other with ourselves. To do that with one another and to do that with God. As I've tried to explore some of the terrain inside my soul, I have no idea whether all of our souls are designed the same way or whether each soul is unique or exactly how that works. But the way I pictured it for myself as though there were several chambers or several rooms in my guts that are all right next door to each other. One of those would be sexuality, another is spirituality, another is natural beauty, a fourth one is music, a fifth one is intimacy in terms of sharing depth. There are several of those rooms, and then the more I explored that terrain in there, down there, wherever that is, the more I explored that in myself, the more I discovered that it really wasn't as though there were separate chambers. It was almost as though, it's like in those old Midwest houses where you've got the living room and the dining room and the kitchen, and they have a kind of a big frame around the, no real wall, just kind of a sense that they're different and yet they're together. And that's one of the reasons why I think we have so much difficulty with people who are in helping professions and committing sexual indiscretions and not realizing where the boundaries are. Because those zones of intimacy are all interconnected and all adjacent and interwoven. If two of us are sharing something of natural beauty together, that's very close to sharing sexuality together, or music. Any of those, they all for me anyway, they all flow together, and they're all part of that, part of what it means to be me as God has created me. And that, all of that within me is not complete unless I have a way that I can share that with someone else, and that someone else can share who they are with me. That's the way I'm conceiving it. I don't know if that works the same way for you or not. And for me then, as I read through a book like Song of Solomon, and I think one of the reasons it's becoming more and more one of my very favorites in all of Scripture, is not because I need to sit down and analyze, well, now what would this verse mean if I take it spiritually? Or what would it mean if I take it sexually? Or whatever else. The language just stands by itself and conveys and communicates across all of those lines. It obliterates all of those lines and speaks my own need and the fulfillment of that need.
Could I ask a question?
Yes.
I'm wondering whether any of us here have heard sermons from this book.
Elmer?
I have.
You have? Good.
I preached it.
All right.
I'd like to say that what you were describing works for me as well. When you start the day talking about spiritual and sexual, my reaction is that it's two sides of the one coin.
Yes.
And the history shows how we got to where we are, because those have been torn apart
yes.
by the societies and cultures, and by this is reflected in the Mary study as well, and that the body was the negative part, the soul or the mind was the positive part. The body was the woman, the negative part. The mind was the man, the positive part. And it pulled all these things apart, rather, as you said, there aren't any really walls inside of that soul. And we're still overcoming that from Greek and Rome, and especially Pietism in Europe, which influenced almost all the people who have taught us about sexuality.
Yes.
And also that we still tend to make sexuality sex, that it's genital sexual sex activity,
yep,
rather than the whole of our being. And then it makes sense for the Song of Solomon to be about all of that at the same time.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that, one of the ways in which I, which for me, this book helps with that too, and helps keep sexuality from being purely genitality, is the way that Song of Songs evokes all the senses. How many smells there are throughout Song of Solomon, or how many aromas and tastes and sounds, and I haven't gone through to look at them, to look at it categorically that way, but it's a, it draws out rather than narrows down. Yeah. Others of you? How many others of you have heard sermons on the Song of Solomon? I think it was Bernard of Clairvaux, or one of those fellows back at that point in the Middle Ages, wrote 82 sermons on this book. Something like that. On the, most of you got a copy of this purple sheet. Of course, I chose purple for passion. Although, if I really were into colors, I could tell you the exact kind of purple this is, but I'm not that far along yet. There aren't enough, I'm afraid. There are only 40 copies, and there are more than 40 of you. So, if there's somebody who can't see a copy, you might want to glance over someone else's shoulder. Just to show you what I've done on the sheet here, most of it is an outline, which really isn't an outline, it's really just titles of pieces, of sections of poetry. I give you my name for them. It's just really a kind of a thumbnail piece. Phyllis Tribble, in one of her books, God and the Rhetoric of Sexuality, divides it up in a traditional way into five major movements, so I want you to see what those are. And then one of the new handlers of Song of Songs is Marcia Falk, who's written a new translation of, she's really a poet redoing the poetry of Song of Solomon for the West. She's treating it not at all as anything biblical or anything like that, but simply as love poetry. So she's got some translations too. She reads it as 31 separate poems. To me, it's much more interconnected than that. But that's what most of this is. The column that you see labeled speaker with she and he, one of the difficulties in reading Song of Songs in English is that we don't have clear indications of who's speaking, where the Hebrew language itself has a whole lot more indicators of the speaker, of the gender of the speaker. And one of the things you discover at that point is that it's the woman who's doing most of the speaking in this book. The man speaks a few times, and there's a chorus of men and women that speak sometimes, but it's usually the woman speaking. No snide remarks now. Cut it out. I think actually that's something important that we'll come back to in a moment. I wanted to give you a quick list of some of the ways in which this book has been handled throughout history, just to show you some of the variety. The most common has been the first, the allegorical, which is the one I was talking about with that Bible study that broke down by chapter 2. The allegory comes in several forms. In Jewish circles, the two lovers are God and Israel. In Christian circles, Christ and his bride, the church. Or on Christian individual level, Christ and the soul, which is really closer to what St. John is doing, although I don't see him so much allegorizing with it. The second kind is really more what St. John of the Cross and also Eugene Peterson are doing, and that's seeing it as a spiritual, sexual piece. It really is two sides of the one coin, and conveying both of those at once. And for that, I would commend you, again, Five Smooth Stones for Pastoral Work, Eugene Peterson's chapter on that, which is in the bookstore. You can pick that up. Some excellent stuff. A third is the cultic, and this is probably the one that's fallen most into disfavor. There was a while when scholars were trying to trace this as coming out of ancient Near Eastern divine marriage practices, where the king would, in special occasions, the king would have sex with a priestess who represented the love goddess to to dramatize, and it was the renewal of nature and those kinds of things. That interpretation is falling into disfavor lately. Fourth, and one of the ones I've enjoyed, is the dramatic, that this is really a play. And there are two versions of that one. It's either a play with two characters, the man and the woman, carrying on whatever kind of acts and scenes are you discern through there. Or the one I like better is the three character one, where you've got the hero, the heroine, and the villain, the shepherd, the shepherdess, the two lovers, and the villain is King Solomon, who wants to take her into his harem, and she's trying to escape there, and the rustic shepherd and shepherdess get away from the king's power. I think that there's something in that, but that's kind of falling into disfavor as well. A fifth is the lyrical, and that would simply say these are love poems. That's what Marcia Falk is doing in her translations, and they work very well that way. As I look at ancient Near Eastern parallels, the closest parallels that we have in the ancient Near East to Song of Solomon, I'm convinced, are Egyptian love poems that have strong similarities to the kinds of imagery and the kinds of phrasings that are in Song of Solomon. And those are purely love poems also. There's nothing cultic about those. So I think even in terms of Near Eastern parallels, the lyrical has much to support it. A sixth interpretation, courtship and marriage. This is especially come out in more conservative Christian circles, where this book has been seen as King Solomon's manual on courtship and marriage. And you go through the order of the book and watch the courtship progress and finally culminate in marriage and in full union with one another. The biggest difficulty I have with that interpretation is the question, is there any evidence in the poems that these two are married? I think there's more evidence that they're not. They're wanting to slip away into secret places where no one will find them, to get away from others. And there's some problem with it. Now he does call her my bride several times. One of the problems with that is that in the parallel line he'll often call her my sister. If you're going to take one of those literally, are you going to take the other one literally too? Is this an incestuous marriage? Or if you're going to decide to take one literally and the other not, which one will you do in poetry like this? So that's a live issue. Is this couple married or not?
Well, would somebody like King Solomon do a lot of courtship?
I wondered that too.
King of that type, hey, I like you. I don't know that there would have been a lot.
One and two and three, Genesis 2 and 3 especially. And there you see the gift of intimacy and sexuality given and then broken, ruptured in chapter 3, or damaged. So that the intimacy and wholeness that's there in chapter 2, by the time you get to the end of chapter 3, has turned into distrust and the subjugation of the woman under the man. And specifically the line, she connects not only the imagery in there, but also the line, your desire, when God speaking to Eve, your desire shall be for him, but he shall rule over you. Mm-hmm. And that phrase shows up again in Song of Solomon, but in a positive way. My beloved is mine, I am my beloved's, and he is mine, and his desire is for me. That one is now turned around. So that as Phyllis Tribble is looking at these, Song of Solomon is taking the gift that is damaged in Genesis 3 and showing it now whole again and redeemed, as holding it out there for us as a sort of a goal or as a gift that God is leading us toward. And I would want to say a gift that Christ is giving us again and healing for us, at least in the process of doing so. And it's in that interpretation is one then that looks at the fact that it's the woman who's the primary speaker in this, the woman whose voice is put down through most of Scripture, and now she gets to be the primary speaker here. There's some sense of healing and redemption going on. I like that. My favorites of all that list, the ones that speak the most to me, are B, the spiritual sexual, E, the lyrical, and H, the renewed garden. Those are my personal favorites. I'm not going to ask you to pick one. couple of paragraphs from Peterson's Five Smooth Stones. This is how he starts the chapter on Song of Solomon. The title of the chapter, by the way, is The Pastoral Work of Prayer Directing. She came to see me at the recommendation of a friend. She had been troubled for years, seeing psychiatrist seriatim and not getting any better. The consultation had been arranged on the telephone so that when she walked into my study, it was a first meeting. Her opening statement was, "Well, I guess you want to know all about my sex life. That's what they always want to know." I answered, "If that's what you want to talk about, I'll listen. What I would really be interested in finding out about, though, is your prayer life." She didn't think I was serious, but I was. I was interested in the details of her prayer life for the same reason that her psychiatrist had been interested in the details of her sex life, to find out how she handled intimate relationships. I had to settle for the details of her sex life at that time. Sex was the only language she knew for describing relationships of intimacy. At a later time, when she came to understand herself in relation to a personal God, she also learned to use the language of prayer. "I like to tell the story," he says, "because it juxtaposes two things that crisscross constantly in pastoral work, sexuality and prayer. And it juxtaposes them in such a way as to show that they are both aspects of a single created thing, a capacity for intimacy. Much of pastoral work has to do with nurturing intimacy, that is, developing relationships in which love is successfully expressed and received, shared." What are you thinking? Where would you like to go with this? What's tugging at you that you're dying to say?
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
In your studies, what have you found as to why this book was included in the canon?
As to why?
Why they allowed this to be a part of the canon.
On a human level or on a divine level?
Human, I'd say.
Okay. It's not really known for sure. It's because in most of the decisions about what books get included in the canon and what don't, reasons are not given and the discussions are not. But actually we do have some of the discussion about Song of Solomon. It was, for all the Old Testament books, it was Jews that made the decisions, and the Christians later on rubber stamped it and says, "Those sound good, we'll keep them." That's essentially how it worked. And so it was in the first century AD when rabbis were discussing together whether some of these books ought to be included or not. And Song of Solomon almost didn't make the cut. Probably partly because of changes in views of sexuality over the centuries and thoughts as to what questions as to whether this was really appropriate for relationship with God. Rabbi Akiva, one of the most famous rabbis of the first, he was in the first century, defended Song of Solomon, and I want to read for you his defense. Akiva was right in setting himself against the strong opposition of colleagues who wanted to ban this text from the sacred writings. This is why he dared to say, "The entire universe is not as worthy as the day on which the Song of Songs was given to Israel. For all the writings are holy, but the Song of Songs is the holy of holies." That's really about all we have of the decisions that were made back then. We know there was a fight over this one as to whether it should get in or not. And this very famous rabbi defended it and called this the very center of the temple, the very most sacred place. Was he saying, "Hey, this isn't sexual at all, it's pure spiritual"? Or was he onto something about how the two are joined together? He doesn't say any more than that. So he leaves us with trying to interpret his words as well. But that's, so there was an, that's about all we know. There was an argument about it.
Does homosexuality come into this at all?
If you're asking, does it come into the text of Song of Solomon?
Yes.
Not as far as I can see. The pronouns, both the Hebrew pronouns and the pronominal pieces that are on verbs and nouns and adjectives really indicate a male-female connection throughout here. So on that level, does homosexual relationship come into the text? No, not as far as I can see. But if I change the question to are homosexual relationships within the zone of what we are talking about of intimacy and longing and connection, that's an entirely different question now. Other thoughts, questions?
I think during the long period of the history of the church, the flesh was confused with the body. Where the flesh was really the old nature, and so being transferred to the body was despised, anything having to do with the body. It was evil, and only the spirit was good.
Yes.
And Song of Solomon is the exact opposite of that.
Yep. That's a really important point. Is that a familiar concept to everyone here about the flesh versus body?
Could you repeat that? I couldn't hear it.
Through most of the history of the church, the flesh was confused with the body, where actually the flesh is the old nature rather than the body. And so the body was despised versus the spirit. The spirit was good, but the body was evil.
Yeah. It's a tremendously crucial piece as you're reading John and reading Paul. Both John and Paul use flesh language. They don't use them exactly the same, but they use them similarly. And as John and Paul in the New Testament use flesh language, flesh means our broken nature, standing independent of God and over against God. That's flesh. Where body is something very different. Body is good. But flesh is by nature then twisted and broken. Well, unfortunately, as the church moved then from the New Testament straight into the Greek world that was already infected with a strong anti-body dualism, that went so fast from flesh being twisted, broken, humanness standing against God, to being our bodies are really evil. It's only the spirit that's good. And we've been laboring under that misconception for two millennia. Song of Solomon is one of the best antidotes to that. I don't know where any of you is in your own relationships, in your own dealings with longing and intimacy. I'm sure that some of you have deep relationships, and some of you do not. Some of you are perhaps craving deeper relationships, and some of you are just fine where you are. I think we're all different, and I don't presume to know, and I don't, in this kind of a setting, want to try and meddle in any of that either. I believe that that each of us is created for intimacy, for sharing ourselves and sharing the other that comes to us. And that is a good in its own right. And at the same time, at least I have to say for myself, my most intimate and close relationships, as healthy as they get, are not completely whole. And in fact, it's easy for me to take another human being and make an idol out of that human being, to try to have that one relationship be the be-all and end-all for my own intimacy and sharing. And that means to place someone else in the relationship of God. And that's part of why I would invite you to take Song of Solomon, to read it, to enjoy it, to pray it. Even the more body parts, they're not body, they're beautiful. To take it and pray it and enjoy it. And let God work through that, both to enhance our longing and intimacy with one another, and at the same time, to let this Word of God point us to the one who is the deepest fulfillment of our longing.